Welcome to Juice Podcast. I'm Emily Harmon, and today I'm joined by...
Jamie Good!
I mean, I feel like everybody who's tuning in knows who you are, but in case there's one person out there that doesn't, who are you?
So I'm a geeky sort of dude. I came into wine writing from the side. I started off as a science person. I did a PhD, then I worked as a science editor, but I caught the wine bug in my mid-20s. And then when the internet came along, I started a website, which was one of these hand-coded HTML websites. So if you remember, I'm a dinosaur, I'm quite old. And I was a geek, and that's what geeks did, and that's what the internet was for, we thought, just to do these little hobby sites. But then it grew, and it grew to the point that I've kind of like thought, ah, this is interesting, and I started writing for magazines because I knew I needed credibility, as well as doing the website. Then I got a book deal to write a book called Wine Science, which is fantastic. And then I got a newspaper column the next year, which I've been doing ever since. That was 2005, so I've been doing that for
almost 20 years.
Every week, 7 wines a week. So, I'm a geek, and so I love writing books. I love, I taste and drink a lot of wine, so I write about wines a lot. But I also write about the scientific aspects of wine from the perspective of somebody who loves wine, because wine is full of science. And good science, really interesting science, but all the books out there are like textbooks. So I thought my job, my calling, is to get the science, to bring it to a place where it's interesting and understandable to people without getting rid of the really interesting bits of the science. So that's my job, and that's what I've done with my books. And so I do a bit of everything, really. I'm a freelancer. I've been full-time doing wine since 2008.
And an educator.
Yeah, and so I do lots of masterclasses and lectures and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And podcasts. Don't get paid for them.
I do. Paid in nice wine and good company, I think, actually. Jamie.
Yeah. Fantastic company, yeah.
I think one of the things, obviously I'm biased because we're friends and we've known each other. I think it's almost 10 years since around the time I was at Grainstore,
yeah, because you were sommelier at Grainstore when...
Ah, it's more than 10 years.
I was
years.
There with Mark Andrew...
That was 2013.
When he was at Robeson, and Jasmine Hirsch was in town, and we had a dinner there, and you were serving the wines, and that's where I got to know you.
Yeah, so I think that was 2013, so 11 years.
Oof.
Yeah, it's gone quick. Half of the time you've been writing your newspaper. But I think what... Going back to why I think I'm biased is obviously we're friends, but what I find very refreshing and a little bit unusual maybe, but possibly that's because I'm cynical about wine writers, but you've got quite a dynamic interest in, like, I feel like you have a sommelier's palate in wine. So when we drink wine together, you're kind of always down with like what the cool kids are drinking and the new varietals
but
and
this
stuff.
Is what's
like...
really interesting, because I think that amongst our friends group, and I'm obviously, you know, I'm quite good friends with quite a lot of people in hospitality, which tends to be a slightly younger set, but what amazes me is we all like the same sorts of wines. So there's a subset of wines we would bring along to it. We often have dinners or go around to someone's place and bring some wine. And everyone brings the same sorts of wines in a very positive sense. And there's lots of wines that people wouldn't bring, which is good, because if they brought them, we'd go, that's absolutely disgusting. And even quite famous and expensive wines are quite disgusting. So there's almost this common taste, I think, amongst people who are really into wine. And I think sometimes wine writers are slightly out of step because they have maybe a more commercial palate, or they like riper wines or more obvious wines. And some of them I don't think are geeks. Because the geeks, we all kind of gravitate to the same sorts of wines. And it's also quite interesting to see that taste has evolved a little bit over time. So I remember with Doug Red, a friend of ours, who's Le Cave de Paraine. When I first started drinking with Doug, Le Cave de Paraine quite liked big wines. You know, big wines from the southwest, quite chunky wines. There wasn't the same focus on these lighter reds and more aromatic styles, skin fermented whites, things with high acidity, more delicate maybe. There was a time when we all liked the big wines, but we were in step then as well. It's kind of interesting. There's an evolution of the collective palate amongst wine geeks. And it's really fascinating.
I think as well, like, if you're in the pursuit of flavour and experience and story and the adventure of wine, you naturally do go towards that. And I do think maybe sometimes with some of the more mature writers, or mature, experienced people in the industry, especially with MW writers, it's also what people are exposed to, right? And there's a lot of sort of bigger producers that maybe, and a lot of the trips are funded by, I don't know, I just feel like also what you're exposed to, like maybe, I feel that you, I mean, I know this from you, it's not like you go out and you buy wine on your own budget, right?
You want to do this. So also the other thing is the people, the sort of wines I like and you like, a lot of those folks don't have budget, right? Yeah. And most wine media relies on producers' budgets to fund what they do. And if you just take press trips and you just drink the samples you get sent, you'll be exploring just a subset of what's out there and not most of the interesting stuff. And what I love about what I do, especially the social media and my website, which is free to access, so I don't feel the need to make money out of that.
Yeah.
But if there's somebody made 60 bottles of wine and I thought it was amazing, I'd write about it.
Mm.
I don't need them to put some money behind the publication before they'll cover it. Whereas a lot of publications now, even if they don't declare advertorial, what they're doing is they say, you put some money behind our publication, then we'll give you some coverage. It's a quid pro quo. And that pay to play is keeping people stuck in an uninteresting space when it comes to wine. So I kind of like the freedom that comes from exploring. I'm still a geek, that's the thing. If you stay a geek, then I think there's a chance you'll write something interesting. If you're not a geek,
or at least drink something interesting.
Yes.
And talking about geekiness, I think that could lead us on to our topic for this podcast today.
Right, yeah, we've been
so I wanted to talk to Jamie about his book called Flawless, which is on wine faults. And I think for me, it was a relief when this book came out, because we're all kind of muddling through. And I think still that with certain wine faults, there's still a lot that we don't know, right? But I think it's kind of one of those important, that's where the science is quite important, right? With particular faults. So what led you to write the book?
First of all, it was... initially, this was going to, I did a book in 2011 called Authentic Wine. I did it in collaboration with a New Zealand master of wine, Sam Harrop.
I have it, yeah, the yellow book.
The reason I did that is because Sam is more like technical and straight. He likes things clean. He likes, when he makes wine, he makes very clean wine. He's a New Zealander, you know, he likes the technical approach and doesn't shy away from various additions during the winemaking process. And so he was kind of wanted to do this project on authentic wine. Initially, we thought about writing it, talking about natural wine, but he wanted to. So what I thought with that book is it could be, rather than somebody who's fully entrenched within like the natural wine scene, writing a book about natural wine, because there's quite a lot of those now, it could be somebody who's sympathetic, me, towards natural wine. And this is in 2011. This was before we had any of these wine fairs. I think the first one
was 2011.
Yeah, the real wine fair.
Which was the one at Borough Market.
Yeah. And that was like a revolution, I think. Yeah. We sensed the revolution was coming because I was on all the internet bulletin boards discussing all this stuff. You know? And there was some really cool internet bulletin boards back in the day.
The forum days.
Yeah. And you'd be chatting with people who would like... I remember Frank Cornelison coming up on there before he released any of his wines. You know, he makes these Magma and the other wines, Mungibel in Etna in Sicily, and he was very hardcore at the beginning.
Yeah, they were challenging wines. Yeah.
But anyways, people like that were discussing online, and you'd basically be able to look in at these discussions. And Joe Dressner, the late Joe Dressner from New York, he was a major importer of natural wine to the USA, and he was active on the bulletin boards then as well. And so I thought, well, this is really interesting natural wine. And I think I'd tried my first few natural wines, so I got to know Doug a little bit. And I was fascinated by this, but I wasn't a true believer. I was like somebody who was interested. But I was also, you know, with Sam, his technical winemaking scene, you know, that was very interesting to have that sort of almost scientific appraisal of what's going on. What makes a wine authentic? What makes a wine genuine? Anyway, after that book came out, then we had the plan to do this second book, and we got commissioned to write this book, Flawless. But it was year after year, Sam was very busy, and we just didn't do it. So in the end, I said to Sam, what if I go and do this on my own? Is that okay? And he said, yeah, that's fine. So that was the inspiration for doing it. He really wanted to write a book on wine faults, but he was too busy. And so I took that and...
Like the Olympic torch.
Yes, I carried the Olympic torch in my Olympic pyjamas, you know, running around France. No, and I thought this was really cool to do this project. And he'd introduced this idea, wabi-sabi,
a
mutual friend, Kenichi Ohashi. We asked him to explain what this Japanese concept of wabi-sabi was to a Japanese person. And this wabi-sabi concept, I think, is a really important starting place in the discussion of wine faults. Because you have in, you know, if you've ever spent much time with Australian or New Zealand winemakers, they're absolute Puritans when it comes to cleanliness. And if you go and judge these competitions there, they're led by winemakers, and their big fear is awarding a medal to something that has a bit of grubbiness or is not clean.
So. I mean, I have to say, like, I've got a family member who's a winemaker, and I mean, like, Brett, there's like zero tolerance. He's an Australian. Like, him and my brother-in-law and my sister, they are very, very, their threshold for it, they have a very, very low tolerance.
Yes, so it's like that with all sorts of faults. And the really interesting faults, so some faults, you know, backtracking, some faults are, if they're present in a wine, it's always a problem. So I guess we'd call cork taint. If you can spot it, it's a problem. You have to reject the wine.
Yeah.
Nobody in their right mind can say that a wine with some cork taint
is going to be enhanced.
Is good or drinkable.
Yeah.
Other faults are much more complicated, and that's the really interesting area. So, you know, when you learn wine as a student of wine, you learn to recognize things in wine. I remember when I first tried a wine with Britannomyces, when I was, I think it was Domaine Richaume, back in the mid-1990s, and I didn't know what it was. I tasted it, and I had a Crow's Hermitage and we went to dinner, and I tasted it, and it had Brett as well. So I learned to recognize this taste in wine that I didn't particularly like. I didn't know what it was. And later on, much later on, I found out it was Britannomyces. And I was fascinated by it because I didn't particularly like it. But then at that stage, there's lots of things I didn't like high acidity.
Yeah.
Or
which is crazy because now you love high acidity.
Yeah. It's like, that was also a time when I didn't eat cheese, right? I didn't like cheese at all.
Mm.
And then I decided I was on a trip to Portugal and they were offering this... Queijo de Serra, and the Serra de Estrela, the Star Mountains in Douro region. Very interesting raw used milk cheese, and it's quite a strong flavour. And I thought, do you know what? I don't like cheese, but I'm going to try it. And I tried it, and after a while, I actually really like cheese. Cheese is fantastic. And now I love cheese.
How funny.
And so I think that your tastes are malleable, and they do change.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the tastes that you acquire, that take a while for you to acquire, are the ones that are most enduring. They're the ones you really love. I think this is true with wine. The first time I tried wine, I was like, oh, this is not good.
Or beer, like the first time you have beer, it's not always
first
like
beer, you have to kind of...
get into it.
Really, it's not, it's not a childish taste.
Yeah.
It's like coffee. It's not a childish taste. Yeah. But you grow to, like olives as well. You first taste an olive, you think, oh, why should people eat these? Or the percebes, the goose barnacles.
Yeah.
You know, the first time you try those, you think, why should anyone eat these? And then after a while, you grow to like it. And so this is really interesting. So Britannomyces really hated it. Now, I know what it is. But what I don't do is as soon as I recognize it, because a lot of people, as soon as they recognize a compound in a wine that's associated with a fault, they say, this wine is faulty because it's got Britannomyces in it. And but the world isn't that simple, and wine isn't that simple.
But that's where I see, like, especially with faults like Britannomyces, it's a bit of a spectrum, right? With how much of it is a positive attribute. There's a line between it being a positive attribute, maybe, or adding to complexity in some way, and then it also being very dominant, that then maybe the wine feels out of balance or overpowered by that particular compound. I don't know, what do you think?
Well, just for the benefit of those listening who aren't familiar with Britannomyces, it's like, what is it? How do you experience it in a wine? So first of all, it's almost always in red wines. But now with the advent of skin fermented whites, you're suddenly finding it in white wines as well. And partly that's because red wines have a higher pH, which means they have less acidity.
Mm-hmm.
So microbes like higher pHs. And Britannomyces is a yeast that grows usually after fermentation is finished. And it kind of just gets in there, starts fermenting slowly, especially if there's any sugar left there or if there's phenolics there. It just likes the kind of the grunge that's left in the wine after fermentation, and it will start growing. And initially what happens is you lose that little sweet bit of fruit at the end of the palate. It becomes a little dry, a bit hard, and then later on you get these slightly phenolic animal-like characters. And when it's full-blown, it's like going into a cow shed.
Yeah.
Or, you know, farmyard smells.
I also a friend of mine also said, who's a winemaker, one of the flavour characteristics was germaline as well, like this almost antiseptic.
Yeah, kind of if you get a cloth fabric plaster and you smell it, it's that slightly medicinal side as well. And so it presents differently in different wines, but generally speaking, it's quite a strong savoury character. And sometimes it can be interesting. I remember speaking to a winemaker once from, I think he was in New Zealand, he was saying he's going through his barrels, and he came to a barrel of red wine, and he said, "Oh, this is really European." And then he realised it's Britannomyces. So yeah. It's like, it's a like savouriness that's quite accepted in certain regions. And I think also there's an overlap between the Britannomyces character and some characters of some
varietal
grapes
expression.
And varieties.
Like Syrah, for example.
Syrah in the Northern
that
Rhone.
That leathery note.
That sort of peppery, spicy, slightly olivey,
but sometimes it
character.
Goes animally as well,
Yeah, can be Britannomyces, but it also can be expression of Northern Rhone Syrah, which can be very meaty and peppery and delicious. And some New World winemakers like go, "That's Bretty," but I don't think it is. I think actually it's just Northern Rhone Syrah that distinctive
style. Also,
like
Sangiovese sometimes as well. Like I've had some pretty.
So I think what I start off with in the book is talking about this idea of perfection, and I say that perfection is not the absence of flaws. It's like to use a religious analogy, we think about this term of holiness. A holy person isn't someone who doesn't do any sins. That's a very negative view of it. So like holiness would be a very positive attribute. So somebody who's got really good qualities, because you can strip away all the bad things, you just don't sin, but you can be a miserable, horrible person and not very nice. Like some religious people can be, you know, the Puritans. I remember Blackadder when they had the Puritans coming round for dinner. Blackadder, the second series, fantastic episode where the Puritans come round, relatives of Blackadder. And they're miserable people. They may not do things that you consider to be sins, but they're miserable. And I think with wine, a perfect wine is not a wine that's free of any flaws, because it can just be a simple fruity wine and it's fine. That's great. We love wine to be simple and fruity sometimes. But there's so much more. So some of the complexity in a wine can be almost like the beauty of the wine is brought out by some elements that in another context might be considered flaws.
It's quite interesting that.
That's the wabi-sabi, yeah.
Yeah, the off notes. Yeah. I mean, because that's something that definitely has worked in perfumery.
Yeah.
Noses will do that.
This is fantastic. So the one of the great examples is jasmine. I love
indole.
The smell of jasmine.
Exactly.
It's got this indole, which on its own is not very nice.
Well, no, it smells like fecal, actually. So it's got a very fecal smell. And florists also use that, right? Like they'll add some indole because then it'll boost all of the top notes.
Yeah. And so that's a very interesting. So some of the blending components in traditional natural perfumery are not necessarily nice things, but they add something.
They enhance the
very interesting.
Yeah.
And that's a really interesting concept for wine. So wine, often you want to counterpoint to the really nice and appealing things that then brings out the beauty in those other components of the wine. And we talked about Britannomyces. So Britannomyces, I think, in small quantities, I think,
pouring some wine
can be very interesting. It's a great sound, isn't it?
Yeah. I did a podcast with my friend Nikki, who's also a friend of yours, and she wouldn't let me make any noise when I was pouring the wine. She's like, "People love this noise." She's like, "I look forward to hearing the pouring of wine." Anyway, I've just poured some wine for you. But carry on, sorry, Jenny.
So Britannomyces, if I was a winemaker, I would do everything in my power to avoid it because it can be uncontrollable. But some people get lucky with it and they make a wine that's got a bit of Brett, sits there nicely in the mix and works really well. Perhaps more interesting fault is the one we call reduction, which is the
presence. Before we go on to reduction, Britannomyces, can we also talk about beer?
Yeah. Great idea, because actually brewers will inoculate with Britannomyces for like a saison style, a farmhouse saison.
So you've got winemakers like running for the hills, refusing to drink wines of Brett, and then you've got brewers actively adding it to the beer to add complexity and create a style.
Yeah, which is fascinating, isn't it? And I do like Bretty beers. So it's funny that with wine, we should say Brett is really bad. And I think it was Alex Hunt wrote very cleverly about this once. He's a wine merchant, Berkman. And he said the thing is, it's like watching a play with the same actors in it all the time. And it's like Brettanomyces can only play one part. You see it in lots of different wines, and it's playing the same role in all those wines. And so it's bringing in a homogeneity to those wines that doesn't come from place.
Mm.
So in some ways, it can be an enemy of terroir. So Brettanomyces can be a fault, and it's perfectly legitimate to describe it as a fault. But it's too simple to say that any wine with a trace of Brettanomyces is faulty. We must eliminate it. I think we need to think more intelligently than that. Some people get lucky, you know, and they have a wine that's Bretty and it's delicious.
Mm.
Some very famous wines have Brett in them.
Also some top Burgundy producers as well.
So what we have to have a more nuanced view.
Yeah.
On faults, rather than just being this police person that says, I spot this compound, we're going to dismiss this wine, not even going to taste it, I just smell it, and this is going. So I think that's a good example. So we've got a very interesting wine in our glasses.
Mm.
It's sort of orange-pink colour.
It is. So we're drinking 2020 Agrade from Skirk, which is from Friuli. It's a beautiful colour, eh? Like, it has that kind of... I don't know, it's like peachy.
So this is presumably skin fermented.
Yes.
So Malvasia, Sauvignon Blanc,
Vitosca, and Pinot Gris. So I think the Pinot Gris is giving it the colour.
Pinot Gris is giving it a lot of colour,
yeah.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah. I think it's Passione Vino who's the importer of this wine.
Beautiful aromatics. So skin ferment often gives you these beautiful aromatics, doesn't it? It's
especially from this part of the world, but I think also there's a lovely like herbal, almost like minty, like spearmint kind of note to it as well on the nose. I'm obsessed with wines, and obviously it's historical wines from Friuli, but also it's a historical region for, like, let's say, richer, more intense, robust, extrovert orange wines.
But there's some tannin here.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of grip. What's kind of interesting with tannins in white wines is you don't get any anthocyanins to produce the pigmented polymers, which is like what gives them a different mouthfeel to red wines.
Yes.
Although there'll be some anthocyanins in the Pinot Gris, so maybe that's helping with that mouthfeel.
A bit more structure.
But it's just delicious. But this is a really interesting wine, because if you presented this to somebody who was classically trained in wine...
Might be a bit scary. It's also a bit cloudy.
It's scary because it's not something you can... put into a category and pigeonhole. Yeah. And this is what I love about wine, is when people are making this sort of wine and like you encounter it and you experience it. And anyone who's obsessed with purity, and often that purity is a historical accident, really. You know, like, for instance, when some people do assessing a wine, one of the things they look for is the clarity of the wine. And that's a historical thing, I think, because in the past, lots of wines were murky and weren't clear. And so to get a clear wine showed evidence of really good winemaking, but now pretty much every wine is clear, so we don't need to be afraid of a slightly cloudy wine. Personally, I don't mind slightly cloudy wines. I don't necessarily need my wines to be clear, but I love wines like this because you're kind of, there's no sort of like official wisdom about how you process this wine, you know. What should you be looking for? What is this good or not? You have to decide for yourself, and I like that.
I mean, I what I love about this is, I don't know if you'd necessarily say that it's the purest wine, just to stay on that terminology, but I do feel that there's an authenticity to this wine,
if you were,
which resonates with me.
An Australian wine judge would reject this, because I think you'd pick up, if you're going to be like super fussy and you've got a forensic palate, I'd say there's a little bit of volatility here.
Yes.
So a bit of volatile acid, not too much, just a little bit. There's also a tiny, maybe a bit of Brettanomyces there as well.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, but there's something a little bit, you know, this would cause a very strict forensic taster to scratch their head a bit and be a little, run a little scared away from it.
And also the palate, like, it's not, for, you know, a wine that's just 4 years old, like, it's pretty, there's the exotic fruit, but there's a savoury core to that wine as well. Salty. It's definitely a little bit more of a challenge. I mean, I love this because I love that it's full of character. And for me, this feels like a really a wine from this place. Feels true to the style of skin contact wines I can taste that limestone soil in the wine, which I think is
interesting. Yeah.
Usually, like a lot of, I'd need to double, like maybe I've just put my foot in it, but a lot of the producers in this area on like, almost like Terra Rossa, you know, like
that makes
like
a lot of sense when you think about the way that the mouth, the wine feels in the mouth, and this is getting really geeky. I'm convinced that I met this guy in Champagne, Joffrey, who's like into this geosensorial tasting, this idea of you can taste the soils in the wine effectively.
I think you can.
Because I think this, to me, the way he was explaining how you experience the wine in your mouth and where, and this to me, I experience on the back of the tongue, I experience that aftertaste.
Yeah.
And that's...
But there's also kind of a shape, thing. There's a shape in the wine as well. Like there's, I think about limestone, like, I mean, I think Riesling's a really good example of this. When you try Mosel Riesling, a lot of it is on, you know, on slate, but then you do have some pockets that are also on limestone. And the difference is, I think, when you try limestone is it's very vertical, but I feel like it's a bit like a firework. It has almost like a sherbety softness at the edge of it. Very different to volcanic soil. When I try one from volcanic soil, it's like a way, like the surf coming in, like almost like with some momentum behind it, and it's like uncompromising from start to end.
So I like this wine a lot. Really enjoying it.
I think so too. You touched on reduction a little bit before.
Reduction is interesting as well. So reduction is the wonderful where some of the attributes in wine that we really like have their origin in these volatile sulfur compounds. So reduction is a term we use to describe presence of volatile sulfur compounds in wine. And these sulfur compounds are very aromatic. They smell very strong. And the simplest one is hydrogen sulfide, which smells of egg and drains. And that's not very nice. If you smell hydrogen sulfide, often early in fermentations, you get hydrogen sulfide being produced. And then because it's a gas, it kind of blows off. But then if it sticks around, you get these more complex sulfur compounds like sulfides and thiols and thioesters, which have very interesting aromas. And sometimes they can be bad. Sometimes they can be quite interesting. And this is one of the faults in inverted commas. That I think is the most interesting because it divides people. But the best example of this is what's called matchstick reduction in Chardonnay. And it's not just in Chardonnay, but Chardonnay is the area where it's become super famous. Because there's a very celebrated Burgundy producer called Coche Jury. And for years and years, people were tasting these wines and they're so distinctive. And it's like there's such a terroir effect. Well, actually, it's a sort of thiol. Benzene methane thiol.
And for those people that are listening to that, where does that come from?
So this is produced by yeast. This is produced by yeasts.
Yep.
And so it's yeast when they get stressed, often produce this. And so winemakers, I think, in my time since I've been writing about wine, because my friend Sam Harrop first introduced me to this concept of deliberately toying with reduction to get this sort of character into your wines. So it's like quite an interesting story. So I wrote an article for trade publications called Harper's based on this, and that kind of led me to really get involved in this whole idea of toying with reduction. So a few people used to do it. It was like considered extremely risky. Now a lot of people do it, especially with Chardonnay. And there's a few ways of doing it, but the way that I find that a lot of people do it is to do with what's called solids at pressing. So when you press a white wine, you get the grapes, you press them. Normally what you do is you settle the juice for maybe 24 hours cold settle. You might use enzymes if you're a techno winemaker. The idea is you get the juice to a level of clearness so that all the debris and all the, you want the juice at a specified level of clearness, which is measured in a unit called NTUs. So people might say, I want to aim for 150 NTUs. So they want the juice to be this sort of level of clarity. So the cleaner you get the juice, the more fruity aromas you get. Sometimes fermentation can be a little tricky because the nutrients have kind of settled as well. So the juice is very clear. It might be harder to ferment, but it produces very pristine, clean wines. Then if you have a dirty ferment, which is a cloudier ferment with the juice with all that stuff in it, then often you get a bit of reduction. And the yeast struggle a bit.
Yep.
They pump out the reduction. You can also get reduction from when people have been spraying sulfur, elemental sulfur in the vineyards. It's used as a fungicide. And if that's present in the grapes, that can then change from being elemental sulfur to not sulfites, which is the oxidized form of sulfur, but sulfides, which is a reduced form of sulfur.
And out of those two options, what would you say is more common in your experience?
More common is using dirty juice, I think. And then the other thing, there's what's called the Rouleau method, famous producer in, in Bourgogne called Jean-Marc Rouleau, who's also an actor. There's a very interesting film, the English title is Back to Burgundy. I saw it on a plane.
I've heard about this, but I still haven't seen it.
He's a star in Back to Burgundy, so he's a good actor, actually. It was a very good film, actually. It's got a French title that's nothing like that at all.
I can't believe it's about Burgundy as well, Back to Burgundy.
It's worth watching if you can find it. It's worth watching. Just see Jean-Marc, it's quite funny. But Jean-Marc produces Chardonnays with that little lovely matched, very well-judged matchstick reduction. He's famous for it. And what he does is he does 11 months in barrel, and then he takes the wines to with the lees to tank for 6 months afterwards. And that tightens them up and gives them a little bit of reductive character.
Mm.
And that's quite popular as well now. But lots of people have got different ways of doing this.
Could we talk about reduction as well in wines that come from volcanic soils? Because I think sometimes, even like if you taste, like, I mean, I'm obsessed with volcanic wines, right?
Yeah.
You and I both are big fans of the wines from the Canary Islands.
Oh, yes.
And obviously there is...
That's a brilliant example. So Jonathan Garcia of Suertes del Marques, who's also making the wines at Tamarind. This is very interesting. So Jonathan's wines are like... He's got a reputation for making, for making quite reductive. The reds as well, very reductive. I like them, but some people find them too much and challenging. And everyone thought, this is Jonathan's winemaking. And then he starts making the wines for my hero, David Silva, Man City footballer, in Tamarind and Gran Canaria. Totally different soils. Suddenly, same winemaking techniques, no reduction at all. Beautiful wines, but they're, they're totally different. And Jonathan says it's the soils, the volcanic soils in Orotava. What they do is there's a nutrient deficiency, I think, in those soils. So the grapes come in, and as a new, as a fermentation medium for the yeast, which is what grapes are, they lack certain elements. So the yeast struggle, and then they start...
Gosh, that's interesting. I'd never thought about it that way.
So I think what it is, so a true expression of terroir, when the yeasts are like struggling a bit, they end up pumping out these volatile sulfur compounds, and you end up with this reduction in the wine. Because of the... It's because of the soil, because the soil isn't giving the grapes...
But I have to ask him then what the difference is between those two wineries in terms of the soil makeup. I think it's a bit more sandy.
Gran Canaria is very different, not volcanic there, I don't think.
Yeah, I think it's more sand.
Yeah, but such an interesting... Then that's a really interesting example of everyone saying, oh, yeah, it's Jonathan's winemaking is reductive. No, this is the soils. This is what it's doing. And I think you sometimes don't see that when people are doing techno wines, because they might add, they might correct the master, they might do things.
And then I guess you've got varietals as well. Maybe the varietal also makes a big difference, say, to that too, with how that interacts with the soil in the final wine as well.
Totally.
Because I also see that reduction a bit in wines from Etna. That same, like, smoky, savoury, sometimes sulfide-y note. And I always do wonder, I'm like, how much of this is winemaking decision and how much of this is soil expression?
I think it's, if you look at the soils in Etna, I went there for the first time last September and had a really interesting time looking at some of those soils, and it's almost
amazing.
Like you're getting fresh soil every few months. You get some of this.
I know.
This weird.
Did you go to Salva Fotti?
No, I didn't.
Because especially where they are, like they're a couple of hundred meters from the nearest crater. So like I've been there twice, and every time there's been like little stones that have fallen from the sky.
An endlessly regenerating terroir. It's insane. Yeah. But some lovely wines there. It's quite a bit bonkers because there's so many producers now. It's like they're like. 20 years ago there would be like 15, and now there's like 300,
and everyone's moving now to like Monte, like to the north, like the north face and like the northwest.
But what a lovely thing to see an area that previously was totally neglected suddenly become very interesting, because partly because there's enough of us geeks who will pay $30 for a bottle of wine from there. So it's interesting the discussion of how the market makes the emergence of a new region possible, because it's like the Tenerife local market's never going to support the wines that Jonathan makes. You know, they're not cheap wines. They're not super expensive. But
and the tourists are not going to be drinking.
Yeah, because, so you need enough people interested enough to be able to pay what those bottles cost for the farming to be done well, for the winemaking to be the right sort of winemaking. And then suddenly you have this new region of emerging, which is fantastic.
Mm.
But reduction, I think, can be very positive in a wine. it can be problematic for some people, but I quite like these wines that are a bit on the edge. And the other thing I love is what I call the ghost of reduction. So when a wine early in its life has seen some reduction, and later on you don't see the reduction, you just sense the ghost of reduction lingering around the wine. It's fantastic.
Yes. I like that. I never thought about it that way. Was it Darren Brown that used to see the ghost? Who was it that used to do those ghost shows on TV?
I don't know. I can't help you there.
To find, dig that up. And
One of our friends, Christina, is a true believer in ghosts. She really thinks...
And she loves good reduction in wine as well. So
she's a ghost reduction person.
Makes sense. Yeah. So to move on, because we touched on this wine that we're almost finishing, I did want to mention quickly, just because we are sitting in the Sherwood Room, which is one of the event spaces in Hamyard Hotel, and we're drinking from the wine list. So I just wanted to give them a little bit of a nod that the wines are from the list there, because they're graciously hosting us today. But you mentioned VA, volatile acidity, which there is a little bit in this wine, and I think we're probably going to get a bit in the next wine that we're going to try too.
Yes.
Again, I feel like volatile acidity is one of those things where some people are very dogmatic and there's a tolerance threshold. I think I've learnt that over the last few years, my tolerance for VA probably is much higher than the average wine person. Talk to us about that.
So volatile acidity, so it's basically the presence of two different compounds in a wine, and they vary in their, you know, which one's taking the lead. So the main one is acetic acid, which is like vinegar. So acetic acid. The other one is ethyl acetate, which is like nail polish remover. Yep. And
this is a little bit more on, I think, find this particular one a little bit more on the acetic edge,
yes,
of that.
Which I think is, so often they come together and in different proportions. And the reason volatile acidity develops in a wine is because of the action of bacteria called Acetobacter. And it likes oxygen. So if you give the wine oxygen in its growing up phase, then these bacteria can often start growing. So managing oxygen during fermentation and afterwards during the maturation phase of wines is quite important, because if the bacteria get going, then you can have volatile acidity levels that get very high. And often some of the VA will come in on the grapes. So you get these bacteria producing sort of vinegary smells at the beginning. So you can be quite careful about not having damaged grapes in the fermentation. And so below a certain level, it adds quite an interesting edge to the wine. So VA can often improve the aroma when it's at a level you can't actually spot the VA. And it also adds a slight, because it's volatile acidity, it gives a slightly sweet acid character to the wine. So the acid tastes a little sweet. It's very interesting. But then it's in the aromas when you get that sort of a vinegary smell on the wine. When you can detect it, I think it's quite problematic. So most of the time you won't notice it, but when you do notice it, it means the level's quite high. And so this is something that divides people a bit. I'm personally, if I notice it, I find it a bit of a problem, but I've kind of sometimes had to press through that to just appreciate the wine.
And a little bit like going back to the perfumery note as well, sometimes a bit of VA also helps lift the aromas in the wine. So it can be sometimes something that might just give the wine a little bit more of a leg up in terms of expression.
It's something we can't be too dogmatic about. And often it comes hand in hand with oxidation. So oxidation is a complicated fault, because some wines are made in an oxidative style and we love them. But there's oxidative and oxidized.
Yeah,
and that's where you have to draw a line. And so drawing a line is often, in life, we have to draw lines.
Big difference between drinking a nice glass of Madeira and a bottle of wine that's been open for 2 weeks.
Yeah, if you open a fruity red wine, leave it open for 2 weeks, you'd taste oxidation.
It takes
flat
that nuttiness as well.
Flat and not very nice. And white wines are oxidized. It's unpleasant, you know. That's why we try to drink wines up, because they lose more than they gain. Mm. But wines that have been made over a long time in a slightly oxidative way, often then they're not oxidized, but there's some character that's come through that winemaking process. And basically, wines, when they're fermenting, they like a lot of oxygen. It helps the yeast. Then as you go to barrel or tank for the maturation phase, you gradually have to keep the oxygen down a bit, and to the point when it's bottled, you've got to be very careful about not introducing oxygen during the bottling process. So it's almost like you go from macro oxidation to micro oxidation to nano oxidation. And it's a very interesting subject, the whole subject of oxygen exposure in winemaking, and I find it fascinating. Personally, I don't want to have VA, but a little bit can be quite nice.
Yeah, I think again, it's like for me, it's with those characteristics. Is it dominating the wine? Is that the thing that draws your focus, because then it draws you away from
yes.
the whole of the wine? That's for me when it becomes a problem.
Yeah.
But when there's a little edge, I don't know. I see it as a little bit like a person or a face. It's like Adrian Brody, you know. It's not like. That very pronounced nose. He's a very beautiful man, and there's that little.
Which
Adrian Brody? He is in Grand Budapest Hotel. He's like one of the bad guys, and he's got a very large nose. He's a very good-looking, handsome man.
What else is he in?
Gosh, I can see the film. He's been in a bunch of films, and I think he was also in a couple of other Wes Anderson films. I can't recall them off the top of my head what else he's been in, but. The Brothers, what's it called? Not Brothers, Brothers Grimm. Anyway, he's a very beautiful man, and his nose is quite prominent. And you could say, "Oh, big nose," not. But actually, I think that's something that makes his face very intriguing. And it's like I think sometimes these slight off notes or
maybe... Asteroid City as well.
Okay, I've never seen that.
That's a good film, actually. Is it?
I like it. Can I pour you another glass of wine?
Yeah. Lovely sound there, Emily. Yeah, I like that.
This one's for you, Nikki. So now we're drinking Tenuta and Fossa, the rosé, which is from Liguria. So it's an old vine rosé. Apparently the red vines here are like 100 year plus, own rooted, overlooking the sea. Liguria is a place I've not been to yet.
Not me.
I really want to go. So like, I think there's a handful of like interesting places.
You know
where
I want to go? Ciro.
Oh, yeah.
Down in the
Calabria,
south.
Yeah.
Because there's a really interesting grape variety there, red grape variety.
I know.
Gagliapo.
Yeah, I think it's Gagliapo. And it's a bit like Nebbiolo. It's very tannic, very structured, but beautiful.
But when it's done well, it's fantastic. I want to go there and try some of those.
I'll happily tag along.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and also I think Calabria it has a lot of potential because there's been a very limited amount of industrial farming, so I think there's quite good soil health there.
So when people start taking an interest in these regions and prepared to pay, you know, the required price for a bottle of well-farmed wine, suddenly magic.
Yes. Agreed.
This is interesting because if you look at the colour, if you were like a, you'd say that there's a little bit of copper, bronze copper to it as well.
Yes.
It's kind of, it's got some pink, but it's got some orange and bronze and copper.
I love structured, powerful savoury rosés. I mean, like Tondonia Rosé, one of my favourite rosés. 2015, by the way, as well. So it's a 9-year-old rosé.
This is fantastic.
But it's got that lovely, like, this for me is very umami.
Yeah, it's got a, there's a sweetness to the fruit, but there's a savoury,
it's like a red rice sake core. Almost.
Is this expensive?
That's a very good question. I'd need to double check. I don't think it's crazy expensive. It's definitely somewhere between £60 and £80 on a wine list.
It's really good.
Yeah.
And it's got this is an example of what I think oxidative but not oxidized. Yep.
No, exactly. There's a nuttiness there, but it's intentional. Yeah.
But there's some fruit as well. It's this beautiful melange of fruit, of savouriness, of nice acidity but not overpowering, but then this intriguing sort of.
But it's not, it has this like...
Tea-like stewed plum.
Totally, but then almost like this apple-y kind of like freshness that makes you go there as well, but it's nutty. Umami, like there's really almost like a touch of rancio, like that little kind of sherry kind of note that's there. And there is a little bit like VA again, right? There's that hint of nail polish remover that's there on the nose.
Yeah.
It's not got acetic like the wine before.
It's a little edgy in a nice way.
Yeah.
It's like, this is the thing that frustrates me about people who really decide that they don't like natural wines and delight in telling everyone how bad natural wine is. Usually they haven't tasted that many, to be honest. but they still feel the urge to tell everyone else that what they like is wrong. It's just really bizarre. is that you come to a wine like this, and yes, it's not something you can easily categorise, but then you go to the cheese board,
yeah,
and you've got cheeses of all different flavours, and some of them are wild and crazy.
Yeah.
And the same people will attack a cheese board and have the most crazy cheeses with some flavours and aromas that are definitely out there, especially like blue cheeses or very soft cheeses.
Mm.
But with wine, they want to stay in a very comfortable lane. They don't want to go off road.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I don't know why that is.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, actually, because, I mean, I've definitely, some of the, let's say, most complex or savoury or sometimes challenging flavours I've had in cheese, and really people, anyone will eat blue cheese.
Yeah.
Or like something like a poisse, for example, which is like, I mean, it really smells like horse piss.
What you've got to do is you've got to make your choices for yourself. And as a critic, you make choices. And this is another question that's very interesting. So you make your choices, that's fine. But then don't bash other people for the choices they make. What they put in their mouth is their business in some ways.
Yeah.
And if they love it, enjoy it.
That's a good that's a filthy t-shirt to have, yeah. Jamie. What I put in my mouth is my business. Nikki, yeah,
Nikki would do that.
She should make a hat or a pair of socks.
Yeah.
So our friend Nikki makes hats, which say, pass me the fucking vino.
And she also makes amazing, she does some amazing high-end sort of dresses
vintage.
And everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not just the vintage, she's doing some really interesting, she showed me some stuff. Yeah. Second Stories, yes. Is her Instagram handle.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway.
We digress.
I was saying about that these people who feel the need to criticise wines of a certain flavour, we don't need to do that. But the question that was really interesting is, how do we decide whether wine is good or bad? Because we do it all the time.
I have a criteria for that, don't
when
you?
When we go to a wine region, you know, we'll say, you ask people, you say, who are the best producers here? They'll come up with a list. And if you ask five people, you probably have...
some overlap.
A lot of overlap. And that's interesting, because what's happening here is what I call the community of judgment. So we taste together, you know, we're doing it together now. We're talking about this wine. It's not like food.
Yeah.
When we eat food, we talk about it a bit, but we don't dissect it in the way we dissect wine. And wine professionals getting together, what they do is they dissect the wine and talk about it. And over time, a consensus sort of emerges that some of these wines are really, really interesting. You should try this. Maybe this one's not so interesting. Maybe that producer's not performing at the same level, so those wines aren't so interesting. But it's the community of judgment. We decide together which things are good and which things are bad. So it's a kind of like aesthetics, but done with a committee.
So
if you've got some expertise, then you have the ability to contribute to this conversation.
Yeah. And what's your let's zoom in. What's your criteria for a good wine? Judging aside, just the Jamie good.
Well, I think it's going to be. I think I believe in authenticity, so I want something that's so the intention matters. So somebody trying to do something in an authentic way. Someone trying to make something interesting and then has the competence and the farming know-how to actually deliver that. I love it if it's got a local flavour. So terroir, I like a wine that where someone has sensed the energy of that place and is then working in line with that energy to produce something that has that local characteristic flavour. And it might be initially they make the wines on their property. They may have five different plots. They make them all the same way. And they start recognizing the signature of each of these plots, like tuning a radio. You start getting close to the signal, the old-fashioned analog radio, where there's lots of noise. And then suddenly you get a radio channel. And you think, well, I'm getting that signal. And you tweak it to get that signal clearer. And I think that's good wine growing, where you sense this is what this plot wants to be and can be. You know, as it expresses itself through a wine, and then through my winemaking, I'm going to try to amplify that signal a bit and clean it up a bit so that you get a clear expression of that place. You get the vintage as well, but you also get that year-to-year consistency of what that place can deliver in terms of wines. And then that, for me, is very interesting. So I like wines that... I'm really into wines that have got freshness, detail, precision, purity, focus... I don't always, you know, obviously wine drinking is often mood driven in some ways. We want to almost like, it's like a painter wants a palette of different colors to then blend and use. So with wine, I think it's nice to have a palette of different wines you can call on and then use in different situations.
Mm.
So I'm kind of like open-minded when it comes to choosing wine, but in terms of quality, then I think that, you know, people talk about things like balance, length, intensity, concentration.
I would say balance is important to yes. some degree. Like, that would be the one for me. Balance and some level of complexity, possibly.
Yes.
But also there are sometimes wines that I don't necessarily want complexity in, but I still could appreciate.
Yeah, and not every wine drinking experience has to be like a great mammoth wine drinking experience. That's like the, you hear about collectors who
sometimes you're on the beach and you just want yeah. that lovely, fresh, zippy wine.
Wine is very context yeah. Driven and situational. And it's like, I'd say that quality is fitness for purpose. So wine quality is like, well, what's the purpose of the wine? It's like a carpenter with their tool set. So she or he might decide they want to saw a plank in half. Then a hammer is useless for that, but a saw is very good for that. And if they want to hammer a nail in, then a saw is not an appropriate tool to do that with.
Yeah.
You can do it, but just yeah. be awkward. So find the right wine for the right context, and suddenly we can talk about quality.
Agreed. Like that. Going on to our list of wine faults that we haven't touched, I think there are two others that we should at least cover. One, we should just breeze past cork taint, because I think, everybody probably knows it, but just in case somebody doesn't.
So it's when you get a wine, instead of getting something fruity, you get something musty, cardboardy.
Wet dog, wet, damp.
Yeah, damp, and it just doesn't smell right. And it's a distinctive, almost mushroomy, fungal sort of smell.
Mm.
And it's a big problem with cork. It's less of a problem now, but it used to be a huge problem. When I started drinking wine, I used to encounter it quite frequently. Now it's really rare when I get a corky bottle.
No, but you do get it on like ingredients as well.
Yeah. And that sort of musty smell produced by fungi, you can get it in shoes, you can get it in...
lemons.
Yeah. I had a pear the other day that had...
Once you know that aroma,
it's like
it's almost a curse, because you're like, oh, so many things I used to enjoy, now I'm picking it up in this.
Where I used to work, the tap water had this musty TCA tank. So it's like you drink the tap
because
water.
Because there was because of chlorine in it, or what?
Yeah, partly because of chlorine, and then but also something had grown some fungi.
Yeah.
That produced the
TCA,
and you only need a tiny, tiny bit to cause this taint. And we're susceptible to, we're sensitive to it because it's an indication that fungi have been growing somewhere. So we're very, it's like an aversive thing. It's like, do not eat this, because fungi produce lots of toxins. Some of them can be very nasty. So it's warning, saying that this thing is a little bit mouldy, so you just don't want to eat it. The fact that we find that smell really aversive.
Yeah, it's interesting.
So cork taint, yeah, if it's present, it's really bad. Lots of ways to try and cure it, but ultimately, with the rise of alternative closures, we're seeing it much less often.
Yes, yes. And obviously, the most mysterious taint of them all.
Mouse.
I feel like this is the topic that's going to be the hot topic still, because I think there's still so much unknown stuff around mousiness. And I mean, I definitely have a high sensitivity to mouse. And I think for people that are listening, and not everybody can detect mousiness, but for those of you that can, how would you describe mousiness?
Well, it's like, the reason it's called mouse is it's like mouse cages, yeah. but not many people have kept mice or pets, but it's a kind of biscuity.
It does, it's like a
savoury biscuity.
I feel like I know it sounds weird, but I remember once us burying a mouse in the family garden that a cat had brought in, right? Our cat had brought in, and I remember I wrapped it up in kitchen paper and put it away, and we didn't get around to burying it till like a few days later, and I opened it up, and then I saw this mouse that had kind of, you know, like it almost sort of started to be like a murder cutout, you know, like it become
rigor mortis.
Well, no, it like he had shriveled down, like,
oh,
it was shriveled. Like a, it was like a dried out mouse, right?
And I remember looking at that. Mouse.
Yeah, and I remember looking at that and being like, and it's really weird. If I think of mousiness, I think of that little old dead mouse, and then I also think of like an old digestive biscuit.
Yes. the biscuit.
Like it's a combination of the two.
So, yeah. So the it's key thing taste. About mouse is that you can't smell it.
It's a taste, though, isn't it?
Like, so as you smell it once it's in your mouth, because what happens is your mouth pH, so that your mouth is less acid than the wine. And so the pH of the wine is lower and the pH of your mouth is higher. So when wine goes into your mouth with these tetrahydropyridines, which are the compounds that cause it, it makes them volatile.
Gosh, that's so interesting. So it's the saliva. Because I thought, so that's a misunderstanding I had in the past, because I thought it was a temperature thing, which is why I always taste it at the end of the palate. But it's because there's more saliva interacting, which is why you get it later.
If you want to check wines for mouse, another thing is to rub it on your skin.
Yeah.
To put the wine on your skin, then smell it, because then
pH of the skin.
The pH of the skin changes it. So you need to change the pH, and then you can smell the tetrahydropyridines, which give that mousy character. So often when you're into tasting, you'll be tasting a wine and you taste it, and then a few seconds later, after you spat it or swallowed it,
I know it's the worst.
Then you go, oh, it's mousy. And it dawns on you that you recognise that mousy character.
Nothing worse than when you're tasting with the producer and then you're like, I've already said I'm going to taste all the wines, and it just realised the first
It's a problem mousy. Because it's like, what do you say? Especially if you're barrel tasting in a winery and you taste the mousiness, do you say anything? But the answer is, if they're showing you the wine, they don't detect it.
Mm.
Or they're in denial. And so it's probably not a great thing to say, this is mousy.
Mm.
I've got signal with one of my friends when I taste with them, and we kind of indicate with our faces, we have a little facial expression that this is mousy.
Yeah.
So we don't need to say anything to the producer. And because the other thing is that the mystery about mouse is that it sometimes goes away. And then it comes back and then it goes away.
So I think it goes dormant, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
But what we do know is that if you sulfur the wine,
yeah,
it's not there.
Yeah,
right.
Because so this is mainly something we found quality. It's produced by bacteria growing wine. So higher pH wines with no sulfites, that's the risk territory for mouse.
And also, I've learned from some of the producers that I import through my import businesses that certain conditions, like for example, if the first fermentation doesn't finish completely before malolactic starts, that seems to be. That's the kind of danger perfect scenario where that can happen. What else can cause mousiness that we know today?
I don't know, really. I spoke to lots of people about this, and it's still shrouded in mystery.
Right.
That's annoying. You know, if you're making wine, it's like some people never get it, and some people just get it with one cuvée, and it's like it's such a bummer. And the other thing is sometimes you get a wine, and I taste it, and I don't taste mouse, but I think, I know I need to finish this bottle within an hour
because
it's going to go mousy. And inevitably, if you don't, then you leave it the next day.
It's undrinkable.
It's completely undrinkable.
Do you think as well, like our lack of knowledge around mousiness is also because a lot of the science that's been gathered around wine vaults is usually funded by people with cash. And if you're one of those producers with cash, you're probably sulfuring the wine that you're not actually encountering mousiness so much.
It's not... I know that the Rhone guys and the Beaujolais guys are investigating this because it's quite widespread in the region now. But a lot of people are not using sulfites until bottling, and then obviously that raises the risk a bit. But it's great that you see that there's a real change, I think, in a lot of French wine regions towards working a bit more naturally. They may not be, say, they're natural winemakers, but there's a trend towards less intervention, and that's fantastic. But then it does come with the risk of things like mousiness. But I think it's a risk worth taking.
Mm. I mean, if a wine is... Stop doing that. If a wine is mousy, you can sulfur, right? Like, if you think... But do you think that's a fix?
Does it fix it? I don't know for sure. If it's mousy already, then adding sulfites might be a bit late to do that. It's to stop the bacteria producing the things in the first place. It's the key thing.
Any other wine faults that we haven't mentioned today that you feel that we should...
Last one, maybe, to just before we finish, is to talk about light strike.
Ah, interesting. Yeah, cool.
So light strike is where you've got wines bottled in clear glass.
Yep. Like the one glass. We're trying now.
Yeah, yeah.
The old rosé in clear glass.
Obviously, pretty much every rosé sold in the globe now is bottled in clear glass because of the colour. It's lovely to see the colour in the bottle. But it does raise the risk of light strike, which is basically, again, we're talking, there's two mechanisms. The main one is just producing volatile sulfur compounds, again, in the bottle with the exposure to light. And so there's quite a bit of research going on looking at how the precursors to this problem of light strike can be removed from the wine. And that would be great, because then people can market their wines in clear glass, fantastic, because it looks so nice and they sell the wine, yet avoid the risk of light strike. So it's a particular problem with sparkling wine. And what's interesting is in the UK, I don't think there's hardly anyone using clear glass now for their sparkling wines.
Yeah, I don't know.
Especially
anyone.
The sparkling rosés. The UK wine producers have been very disciplined about not using clear glass, because sparkling wine is particularly at risk of developing light strike.
Yeah.
So that's the last one.
That's good. I think that was a nice way to finish.
Fantastic to chat with you.
Thank you for your time. Yeah. I know it's very valuable. For our listeners who want to find this book.
Yes, so the book in question is called Flawless Understanding Faults in Wine. It's available from University of California Press and the usual sort of outlets. It's also available in Italian, called Il Vino Perfetto.
Your Italian's remarkable, Jamie.
Il Vino Perfetto.
And if everybody could see, he's even got the gestures
you
to
have
go
to,
with
just
it.
To pronounce Italian. but also, if you want to find any of my stuff, then I'm on the interwebs. So Instagram is Dr. Jamie Good, DrJamieGoode. I think on Twitter, now X, is just Jamie Good. And my website, which has been going since the late 90s, is wineanorak.com.
Thank you very much, Jamie. It's an absolute pleasure to have you. And it is a great topic that I feel that a lot of people are going to get benefit from listening to this podcast. So until next time, I'm Emily Harmon.
I'm Jamie Good. Cheers.